Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, with the latest lethal mass shooting in America, we spend the hour analyzing how the Second Amendment came to be interpreted as a right to bear arms for individuals, and then how this change in constitutional meaning compares with other changes in constitutional meaning, including marriage equality and human rights protections. With us is Professor David Cole. He is a law professor at Georgetown University Law Center and an award-winning author. David Cole's latest book is Engines of Liberty. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you back with us here, David Cole. You've written this really fascinating book about how constitutional meanings change. And given the shooting that occurred in Florida, I thought really important that we should look at how the Second Amendment came to be interpreted as it is today, as an individual right to bear arms, which you said had been a dead letter as a matter of formal constitutional law for most of U.S. history. How dead, and how had it been interpreted, say, before the Heller case?
So first, it's ironic that this horrific event took place in Florida, which has sparked a national conversation once again about what we can do to control the guns in America, because as I tell the story of the Second Amendment in my book, Florida is really the sort of ground zero for the National Rifle Association's campaign to turn the Second Amendment from a provision that did not protect any individual right to bear arms, as it was interpreted by the courts for over 100 years, into a provision that the Supreme Court in 2008 said protects an individual right to bear arms. So for over 100 years, the federal courts were uniform in their view that the Second Amendment protected the prerogative of states to form militias, which when the United States was first founded, there was a concern about the possibility of the federal government having a standing army and using it for tyrannical purposes. And the idea was, well, you authorize through the constitutional Second Amendment, you authorize the states to each have their own militias, which will be a counterforce to federal power. But for a century or so, the court said that's all the Second Amendment is about. It's about the prerogative of states. It does not protect the rights of individuals to have guns for their own purposes, whether it be self-defense or hunting or fighting tyranny. And indeed, this view was so widely held that Chief Justice Warren Burger, who was a Republican, conservative justice, appointed by Richard Nixon, said in 1991 that the notion that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms is one of the greatest frauds perpetrated on the American people by a special interest group in his lifetime. And yet, 18 years later, the Supreme Court recognized that right as founded in the Constitution itself.
So let's back up into then how this idea went from being called a fraud by a conservative former Supreme Court justice into really being the law of the land in terms of the Second Amendment and its meaning. You said that the big change, well, it was incremental for many years, for those 18 years, but the big change then with the Supreme Court was with Heller, the District of Columbia versus Heller. Maybe we should talk about that case a little bit and the McDonald versus City of Chicago, and then trace how we got there. So let's start with Heller. What was that case?
Right, so that was a case challenging the District of Columbia's ban on the possession of handguns. And the McDonald case, which followed 2 years later in the Supreme Court, was a challenge to the City of Chicago's ban on the possession of handguns. And in the Heller case, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 margin, ruled that the Second Amendment, contrary to 100 years of precedent, did in fact protect an individual right to bear arms, and therefore the D.C. law prohibiting the possession of handguns was unconstitutional. And 2 years later in the McDonald versus City of Chicago case, the court extended that principle to the states, and so it is unconstitutional for states or local governments or the federal government to ban the possession of handguns because they interfere with the individual right to bear arms.
Now, one of the things you point out and other legal scholars have also pointed out is the majority was written by Justice Scalia, who has passed on. The dissenters looked at the exact same historical record, and they came to opposite conclusions about the meaning of this amendment. Of course, it's very ambiguous, as you rightfully point out. But they all spoke as so-called originalists, trying to understand the original text of this. How does this make sense about the vastly oppositional interpretations from the same material?
Well, historians often disagree, right? And in this instance, four justices read the history one way and five justices read it the other way, giving, you know, more or less significance to various pieces of evidence. But, you know, there certainly is evidence to support the notion that there was some intention to protect an individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment. One piece of evidence that the gun rights folks pointed to was the fact that we inherited the right to bear arms from England. And clearly the right to bear arms as it existed in England is not a prerogative of states to have militias to fight against the national government. There was no such thing as states, and so it was a right of individuals and was understood as a right of individuals. They also pointed to contemporaneous constitutional commentators who described the right as an individual right, in addition to a right of the states to have militias. On the other hand, the dissenters pointed to the fact that most of the discussion in the debates on the Second Amendment were focused on the importance of having state militias that could be a bulwark against tyranny imposed by this newly created federal government through a standing army. They were very concerned about a standing army and very concerned to have something as a check. And so the dissenters viewed emphasized the state prerogative point, and the majority said, no, we think the state prerogative is part of it, but it's not exclusive, and there's also an individual right. But the point of my book really is that that debate, which, you know, historians can, reasonable historians can disagree about what's the best reading of the historical material. And there are historians on both sides, just as there are justices on both sides. But my argument in the book is that this case was not decided by competing understandings of history. It was decided by a shift in the political landscape that was effectuated by the National Rifle Association through a long-term, decades-long strategy of incremental reforms, so that by the time the issue got to the Supreme Court, the position of the NRA, which had been dismissed as a fraud 20 years earlier, could prevail. And that's not originalism. That's really constitutional democracy. What the NRA did was use the levers of democratic power to spread a norm, a concept of individual rights to bear arms, to self-defense, and the like, so that it was so widespread by the time it got to the Supreme Court that it was a small step for the court to recognize it.
I thought it was really a great lesson in constructionism, you know, how these things are constructed, meanings are constructed. When you mentioned the NRA, I also found fascinating in your book about the roots of the NRA, that it really did not start out as an organization that was trying to defend everybody's right to have and carry handguns, that even the organization has vastly changed from what it originally was. I wonder if you could walk us through a little bit of that from its inception to what it has become and how you see that change.
Sure. So the NRA is a very old organization, one of the oldest nonprofit organizations in the United States. It was founded after the Civil War by Union generals who were just astounded at what poor marksmen the Union soldiers were. And they felt that what was a marksmanship organization that would get people trained, you know, how to shoot a rifle and hit the side of a barn door. And that's really what it was. It was a marksmanship organization, a sporting organization, a hunting organization. For the first, you know, 100 plus years of its existence, it did not create a political lobbying arm. Today it's seen as perhaps the most powerful lobby in America. It didn't even create a lobbying arm until 1975, over 100 years after it was founded. And so the NRA that we sort of know today, this very powerful political force that politicians are afraid of, etc., really didn't come into being until 1975 when the legislative arm was created. And then they had started to have second thoughts, and the leadership was thinking, well, actually, we don't really want to be a political organization. And they were planning to move out of Washington altogether, close the lobbying office, when in 1977, a group of sort of strong individual right to bear arms members succeeded in essentially what they call the revolt in Cincinnati, where the annual meeting of the NRA was, and they got the bylaws changed to put the defense of the right to bear arms as the number one goal of the NRA, and they put in charge of the NRA a number of people who were very committed to that very concept. So it really wasn't until 77 that they started in earnest this campaign. And that campaign, I argue, that number one is the most significant factor in why the court eventually recognized the right to bear arms. And then I believe, even after the Supreme Court recognized the right to bear arms in 2008, it's actually much more the NRA than the court that protects the right to bear arms of Americans, because the NRA is able to block legislation that would clearly be constitutional under the court's understanding of the Second Amendment, and they're able to get gun rights laws enacted that are clearly not required by the Second Amendment. So it's even today, even after they won, even after the court recognized the constitutional right to bear arms, it's really the NRA more than the courts that is the guardian of this particular right for Americans.
And it's fascinating because they, at one point, the organization supported some gun control efforts, including the Uniform Firearms Act.
The Uniform Firearms Law was an early sort of model for state legislation setting up licensing requirements and the like, and I think it was in the 1920s. And yeah, the NRA was okay with it. And in the 1930s, Congress, the federal government, banned machine guns, and the NRA was okay with that. But in 1968, I mean, the real turning point was 1968, and you know, for some people, it's the turning point in terms of gun control, because that's the first time that Congress passed a major piece of gun control legislation, licensing requirements, background checks, things of that nature, bans on certain kinds of people getting access to guns. That was in response to the violence that had erupted in the 60s in the United States, which included, of course, the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and his brother Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And so Congress passes the Gun Control Act of 1968. It was in response to that advance in the interest of gun control that the NRA members who really were concerned about gun rights. She is now in her 70s. She's in Florida. She's a grandmother. She is 4'11". She never went to law school, and she's widely considered the most powerful lobbyist in Florida. And she grew up on a farm. Her grandfather taught her how to shoot, doing hunting rabbits and things like that, but she wasn't political. And then Congress passed the 1968 Gun Control Act, and she felt like her rights, her freedoms were under attack, and she got involved, got engaged with a gun rights organization, local gun rights organization in Florida, and ultimately built that organization up and got connected with the NRA and became the president, the first female president of the NRA, and has been tremendously effective in advancing their interests in Florida. So much so that the NRA start virtually all of its gun rights state legislative campaigns in the state of Florida. And the state of Florida, which is sometimes referred to as the Sunshine State, is also referred to as the Gunshine State because it has been so receptive to gun rights laws, laws that protect, for example, gun manufacturers from tort liability if someone uses their gun illegally and causes injury to another, or laws that give people the right to carry guns in public in a concealed way, or laws that the Stand Your Ground law, which allows people to use guns to defend themselves in public without having to first try to retreat. You know, a variety of things like this. And that's what the NRA did. They said, we want to advance the concept of the individual right to bear arms. We know we can't win it by filing a lawsuit in federal court because the federal courts have rejected those arguments for so long. We would just be another loss. And so what they did was they looked for alternative forums. And this is a key point in the book, is if you're seeking constitutional reform and the federal constitutional law as it exists is not favorable, you can't just file another case in federal court and make another argument. That's not going to work. What you need to do is change the landscape against which the federal court acts. And so you have to find alternative fora. And they started in the states. They focused on the states. They would start in Florida. They'd get something passed in Florida. Then they'd take it to Alabama. They'd get it passed in Alabama. Then they'd take it to Mississippi. And eventually, they would get most of the states to adopt these laws. And so by the time the Supreme Court in 2008 took up the question of whether the federal constitution should protect an individual right to bear arms, the NRA had succeeded in getting an individual right to bear arms protected under state law in virtually every state in the union. And that makes it a much smaller step for the Supreme Court to recognize a federal constitutional right if state law, which is where most of the gun laws are enacted at the state level, already recognizes that right.
It's that whole idea of states being laboratories, I think, that Sandra Day O'Connor used to say about the states.
Right, but what she was talking about, and that's the sort of common conception of federalism is, you know, the great thing about federalism is that we have 50 different governments, and so they can try different things. They can experiment with different ways of regulating society, and people who like one way can go to Utah, and people who like another way can go to New York. And that's great. The diversity is great. But what the NRA realized was that you can also use these forums, not so much as an experiment, but as a way to develop momentum in favor of a particular norm. And once you get enough momentum in the states for the norm, whether it be the right to bear arms or, in the case of marriage equality, same-sex marriage, you then can sort of the argument can, in effect, jump the tracks from state law to federal law. And precisely because it has succeeded at the state level in a significant number of states, it becomes a more credible argument at the federal level.
This would probably fall into that idea that Cass Sunstein used to write about norm entrepreneurs, that these are norm entrepreneurs.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the key is to find forums where if your norm is one that you believe in but it's not recognized by the Supreme Court and by the federal courts, then you need to find alternative fora. And that might be a state court interpreting state constitutional law. It might be a state legislature enacting a state statute. It might be a municipal government, a local government. In some cases, the norms can even be developed at the private sector. The marriage equality movement, which I also talk about in the book, and which had many parallels to the gun rights movement, one of the places they started was with sympathetic businesses, universities, and nonprofits, getting them to recognize domestic partnership benefits, limited domestic partnership benefits for same-sex partners of their employees. And, you know, they then took that and they went to progressive cities and got cities to recognize limited domestic partnership benefits for city employees. And then they took that to some of the states, and they got states to enact domestic partnership benefits. And then they expanded those benefits to the point where they were virtually indistinguishable from marriage. And only after they had made all that progress in an incremental way did they then go into a particular state where they had made this progress and argue in court that there's no good reason to deny same-sex couples the institution of marriage, given that you're already extending to them all of the tangible benefits that married couples get. And like the NRA, the marriage equality groups started in the states that were most sympathetic to them. They weren't Florida for the gay rights groups. They tended to be New England. But so they started in Vermont. They got a partial victory in Vermont. They then took the same strategy to Massachusetts, where they got the first state court decision recognizing marriage equality. They took that to Connecticut, to Iowa, to California, to legislatures in New York State, to the D.C. City Council. And in each of these forums, they were relying on state law, but the arguments were the same that would as would be advanced in the federal courts eventually. Arguments about equal protection, about equal dignity, about rights of privacy, and the like. And by winning them in the state courts, they took a concept that was really unthinkable, 30 years ago, and made it inevitable.
You've said a lot there and a lot to talk about in all of that, including, the argument for incrementalism. And the length of time is also notable. It seems to me, it seems from having lived through parts of these and watched them, that the marriage equality revolution happened in a lot shorter time span than, say, the gun rights, individual right to bear arms occurred. I'm wondering about that aspect of it. And there was also, of course, 10 years before we saw the marriage equality go before the Supreme Court, there was one particular mayor in California who started just marrying gay people as what he thought an ethical thing to do. And that created a revolt, but then it reversed. So there were all of these factors that were different in each case. But it sounds like your argument is they were still incremental. They still started in small places, and then they built them.
The places that groups were most successful was through this incremental steps. And on the one hand, it is a kind of revolution. In all of our lifetimes, same-sex marriage went from something that no one really took seriously to something that now no one can really come up with a good argument against. And yet, when you actually examine the concerted effort by a number of organizations here that were committed to this value, it was a 30-year campaign, really. And it was built on the backs of earlier campaigns for gay rights that, in particular, most importantly, made it safe, increasingly safe, for people to come out as gay or lesbian. Because before people came out as gay or lesbian, there wasn't very much sympathy for gay or lesbian rights. But once people began to feel sufficiently comfortable coming out, then virtually everybody knew somebody who was gay or lesbian, often in their own family, and it became much more difficult to, in an unthinking way, reject their identity, reject their claim to love their partners in the same way that heterosexual couples do, and the like. And that work dates back to the 1950s, at least, when the first sort of self-identified gay organizations began in the United States. I think that's appropriate, actually, when you're talking about constitutional change. A constitution is designed to put certain values and norms above ordinary politics so that they can't be changed by, a momentary set of impulses, unlike ordinary legislation or ordinary politics. It takes a kind of extended debate, dialogue, advocacy campaign over a variety of different forums and locales to shift the ground so that the Constitution can change. And I think that's important because, on the one hand, the value of a Constitution is setting certain rights above ordinary majoritarian politics. But on the other hand, for a Constitution to actually be valid and legitimate, it needs to change with society's changes over time, but it needs to change in a slower way. So the Constitution, the basic question that the Constitution raises is, why should we be bound by a Constitution? If we as a democracy believe that the best way to do something is to pass a law, and it happens to be inconsistent with the Constitution, why should the Constitution trump? Well, I think the worst argument for the Constitution trumping is that, you know, a bunch of dead white men who didn't even represent the majority of the populace at the time that they acted approved it 240 years ago. I mean, that just doesn't have, why should we today be bound by what those that minority of people thought way back when? But if the Constitution has evolved over time so that it reflects our society's most fundamental values in an evolving way today, then yes, we should be bound by it. And this book is really an illustration of how civil society groups, organizations of citizens committed to a particular constitutional vision, work and engage in public-spirited debate and advocacy to evolve the Constitution so that it reflects our most fundamental commitment.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with David Cole, and we're talking about his latest book, Engines of Liberty, where he traces the changes in the meaning of constitutional law in three really distinct areas. It's a fascinating read. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. And we're speaking with David Cole on his latest book, Engines of Liberty, about how the Second Amendment came to be interpreted as an individual's right to bear arms and how this contrasts with other changes in constitutional interpretation, including the right for marriage equality and human rights protections. It's interesting, the convergence of the two areas of constitutional law we're speaking about, the right to bear arms as an individual right emerging simultaneous with the right of marriage equality and other gay rights also emerging, and really a tragedy in Florida where finally people who are gay and lesbian are able to be open simultaneous with this person being able to get any kind of gun he wants and ending up in this tragedy.
It's horrific, and it launched a national discussion about whether our gun laws are too lax and what are the ways in which it makes sense to tighten them up. And I think it's quite possible that there will be some tightening, particularly around barring people who are on terrorist watch lists from being able to purchase guns. That seems something that my guess is that there will be consensus about that. But yeah, I mean, rights come into conflict with each other, and no right is costless. And this horrific tragedy illustrates that point, absolutely.
So a couple of other things that we didn't really get to, but we started to hint at, and one is really the court of public opinion and the role that it plays in the Supreme Court decision-making. How would you assess that?
I think people who have looked at Supreme Court decisions on major issues and looked at public opinion polling on those issues have made the case quite powerfully that the court doesn't actually depart very radically from public opinion on fundamental issues. And when it does, those decisions are much less likely to stand the test of time. So that if you are engaged in a constitutional reform campaign, as the marriage equality folks were, as the gun rights folks were, as the those who were fighting for human rights in the wake of 9/11 were, you need to think about how you affect not just concrete laws at the state or federal level, but how you affect public opinion. And that, you know, requires you to think about messaging. It requires you to think about advertising. It requires you to think about spokespeople, who are going to be your effective spokespeople. So, for example, just with one example, in the marriage equality campaign, when California voters voted in Proposition 8 in 2008 to overturn a California Supreme Court decision that had recognized the right of marriage equality by redefining their constitution, amending the California state constitution to define marriage as a union between a man and a woman exclusively, the gay rights groups were dumbfounded that they had lost that battle. I mean, 2008 was when President Obama was elected, and California is a pretty progressive state, and nonetheless, they lost on that campaign referendum. So, but one of the things they did was they hired a group of outsider political sort of consultants, advisors, to assess what went wrong. And one of the things they found that went wrong was the messaging that they were using to try to convince people to vote in favor of marriage equality. And what they were doing is they were analogizing their fight to the fight for equal rights by blacks in the South in the Jim Crow era, and by Japanese Americans in fighting against the internment during World War II. And they were running ads, sort of making fun of people who were opposed to marriage equality as being out of it and sort of fuddy-duddy and uncool and the like. And what the consultant said was, you need to reach persuadable people. Persuadable people are people who are open to your argument but are uncomfortable with that argument. You don't reach them by casting them as a racist if they're opposed to you, which is what you do when you make an analogy to the civil rights movement. And you don't reach them by making fun of their concerns. And instead, what they did in the ad campaigns that led up to the 2012 marriage ballot initiative referendums, where four states had marriage on the ballot and all four states marriage equality won, was they had only heterosexuals speaking. The older the better, the more Republican the better, the more conservative the better, the more religious the better. And they told real stories about their own journey, essentially, from a point of being uncomfortable with this idea to a point of seeing that it made sense. And usually the turning point in that story was they would point to somebody in their family or, in their group of friends or peers who was gay or lesbian, and they would say, well, and I just couldn't see why Paula, as I've had with my wife of 45 years. And those were, they're very different messaging. And were critical, I think, in turning public opinion around, which then is critical in making a constitutional argument, which, initially was dismissed as frivolous, into a constitutional argument that wins in the Supreme Court.
Another area that made an incremental change and an important change in these was in the field of scholarship. And I found that particularly fascinating, especially with the switch to individual rights with the gun laws. How did that come about in each of these two cases where the scholars essentially transformed academic thought?
The academy is just another forum. Just as the states are forums and private companies can provide a forum, and as I talk about in the campaign for human rights and the war on terror, the international venues can provide a forum. So too, the academy is a forum, and the NRA realized that early on. And what they did was they went out and affirmatively supported scholars who were reexamining Second Amendment history and arguing for an individual rights interpretation of that history. And when they started in the sort of late 70s, virtually every article, law review article, that had been written on the Second Amendment had taken the view that the Second Amendment protects only the prerogative of the states. And then the NRA got involved and they supported a number of scholars. They created prizes. They supported an association of Second Amendment scholars. They sponsored symposia and the like. And by the time they came to 2008, when this issue got to the Supreme Court, the majority of the articles, of law review articles in American law reviews on the question of the Second Amendment were taking the opposite position, that the Second Amendment, properly understood, does protect an individual right to bear arms. And a number of prominent liberal constitutional law professors, including Larry Tribe at Harvard and Akhil Amar at Yale and Sandy Levinson at the University of Texas, wrote prominent articles giving credence to this view. And so, that's another forum in which one can affect change. Those who are now seeking to overturn Citizens United and allow for meaningful campaign finance regulation in the United States are doing a similar thing. They are supporting scholars and symposiums and books and the like that are examining the empirical assumptions that underlie the Supreme Court's conclusion that spending unlimited amounts of money has no corrupting effect on the political process, and trying to show that just doesn't make sense. I see the Academy as another forum, and the NRA certainly used that forum very effectively.
How important do you think that support was in changing the scholarship? I mean, having the discussions and having the prizes, do you think that without those, the scholarship would not have persuaded people like Sandy Levinson and Larry Tribe?
Well, it might well not have, because, they really brought attention to this issue. It was not only were all the articles saying it only protects the states, but there weren't very, very many articles. It just wasn't an area of contention. They made it an area of contention, an area that got attention from scholars, and they supported those scholars who supported their view. Now, some would say, well, they're buying scholarship. I don't think they were buying scholarship, and I interviewed a number of the most prominent scholars in this area who were in favor of an individual rights interpretation. And, they sometimes got prizes, and sometimes they would get subsidized, but the amounts were insignificant, and if you broke it down to an hourly rate, they were nothing. This is not a way. You don't get rich writing law review articles, no matter what you're writing about. So I think, but I do think the NRA created a kind of a focus on this question and brought people who were sympathetic to their view much more prominence in the debate, and that had an effect. Do I think it was the only thing? Absolutely not. I quote Walter Dellinger, who was a former Solicitor General of the United States, who argued in defense of the D.C. Law for D.C., and he took the position that it was the scholars' work that really made the difference in the court. And if you look at Justice Scalia's opinion, who writes the majority for the court, he cites many of the scholars and quotes them and cites the evidence that they have brought to the fore. So I think they clearly played an important role. Certainly not the only role. I think the work I talked about earlier that focused on developing state law individual rights protections was important. The NRA also helped get George Bush elected, and George Bush then appointed John Ashcroft as the Attorney General. John Ashcroft was a longtime NRA member, and the NRA immediately reached out to him and got him to reverse the longstanding Justice Department position, which had been that there is no individual right to bear arms, and they took the position under Ashcroft that there was such an individual right. And the NRA also got Congress to endorse an individual right in two pieces of legislation before 2008. So by the time the Supreme Court takes this question up in 2008, the NRA has succeeded in getting most of the states on board, the academic establishment on board, the executive branch of the federal government on board, the legislative branch of the government on board, and then it's just, waiting for the other shoe to drop for the Supreme Court to come on board.
You mentioned that now there's this movement to try to change campaign finance laws and overturn Citizens United decision incrementally as well. When I look back at the history of the court's decisions on that, it seemed like that was very sudden with Buckley versus Valeo, where over the course of the United States, it had always enabled Congress to pass laws that would stem corruption or support various aspects of democracy. And there were several examples of that from the spoils system. It seems like there are sometimes these decisions, like Buckley v. Vallejo, that suddenly come in and change things. And then that's what then leads to people having to organize state by state and incrementalism. Would you say that's a correct assessment?
I think sometimes. I think most of the time, if you look behind any significant constitutional decision that really changes the lay of the land in an important way, there will have been a campaign that underlies it. I haven't gone back and looked at what was being done before Buckley versus Vallejo. I do know that since Buckley versus Vallejo, you know, there's been a very active and coordinated campaign to undermine campaign finance laws, to challenge campaign finance laws by those who want to free up money in the electoral system. And there's a lot of money behind those who want to free up money in the electoral system. But you know, I think that is one of the most likely constitutional doctrines to change over the next couple of generations. And I think that for a number of reasons. One, you know, it's a very unpopular decision, Citizens United. About 80% of Americans in polls say that they think it was wrongly decided. And that's a very high, you know, number for a Supreme Court decision. There are a significant number of civil society organizations that have taken this this issue on in a very sophisticated way. They are engaged at the local level in trying to get various reforms put in place that can show that we can, in fact, have a kind of equal playing field, democratic politics where people without means have the ability to run for office, and where people with, you know, normal means can have an equal say, and through generous public financing conditioned on candidates not taking large private money donations. There's an attempt to amend the Constitution to allow for campaign finance regulation. I don't think that's going to succeed in any literal way, but it's an opportunity to educate people about this issue. And so, you know, I think over time, it's very likely that decision will be cut back and that legislators will be given more leeway to regulate campaign finance because of the work that citizens working together are doing. In fact, you know, the subtitle of my book is The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. If the title hadn't already been taken, probably a more accurate subtitle would have been The Power of Citizens United to Make Constitutional Law, because this is really a book about how the Constitution changes when we act in associations, act in together with like-minded citizens in defense of the liberties that we believe in. And sometimes it moves in a liberal way, as with marriage equality. Sometimes it moves in a conservative way, as with the right to bear arms. But it is the sort of important sort of takeaway is it's not changing because five justices are imposing their personal views on the electorate. It's changing because of democratic politics engaged over the long term by civil society organizations committed to particular constitutional norms.
We're speaking with David Cole on his latest book, Engines of Liberty, about how the Second Amendment came to be interpreted as an individual's right to bear arms and how this contrasts with other changes in constitutional interpretation. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. And we're speaking with David Cole on his latest book, Engines of Liberty, about how the Second Amendment came to be interpreted as an individual's right to bear arms and how this contrasts with other changes in constitutional interpretation, including the right for marriage equality and human rights protections. At the center of each of these cases that you looked at seems to be an individual who is willing to shop for forums So there's an argument for agency here as well, like individual agency in cohort with other individuals. That would probably lead us to talk about the Center for Constitutional Rights and Michael Ratner's work and how human rights have changed as a result of him and a handful of other lawyers who are willing to take these cases on that in some cases, as in Ratner's case, didn't think they would really go anywhere.
I dedicate the book to Michael Ratner, who was the head of the Center for Constitutional Rights for many years. He just recently passed away. And he is the person who came up with the idea of suing on behalf of the Guantanamo detainees to challenge their detention by President Bush. And I asked him, you know, what did you think your chances were prevailing when you filed that lawsuit on behalf of foreign enemy combatants against the president in wartime? And he said, none whatsoever. We filed 100% on principle. And in some ways, you know, that sort of exemplifies Michael Ratner, exemplifies the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is a group that I actually started my career with. It's a brave and noble organization, and sometimes files cases that are almost certain to lose if it feels that they're important to file on principle or as part of a political campaign. But what I show in the book is that he didn't just file the case, but worked in tandem with lawyers around the world to develop, put pressure on the Bush administration to abide by the rule of law. And so one of the challenges that they faced, the human rights folks faced, that the gay rights and gun rights people did not face, is that they didn't have a natural constituency here in the United States that they could appeal to. Because the victims of most of the excesses of our counterterrorism measures after 9/11 were foreigners. Everybody at Guantanamo was a foreign national, not a U.S. citizen. But they're citizens of somewhere, and so Michael worked with lawyers in other countries to bring attention to those cases in those other countries where people were very concerned because they were their citizens. And I tell a story of Clive Stafford Smith, who's a British-American dual citizen who has an organization called Reprieve, which is situated in London. He represented about 80 people at Guantanamo. He filed habeas petitions in U.S. courts on their behalf, and he got a lot of them released, almost all of them released, but not through those habeas petitions. Instead, what he did was he went to the countries from which those individuals came, gathered up their family members, held press conferences, brought attention in that country to bear on how their own citizens were being mistreated at Guantanamo. That then put pressure on the governments to complain, and the Bush administration had to respond to those complaints. So I tell the story of Tony Blair, who initially was 100% behind George Bush on how the people were being treated at Guantanamo, including the British detainees. But through the efforts of Michael and Clive and a number of others, they brought public opinion around in England to such an extent that Tony Blair had to reverse himself and demand that George Bush return the British detainees. He then did return a number of the British detainees. Those detainees immediately started telling their stories to the press about how they were being mistreated at Guantanamo. And those stories made their way across the pond and affected the course of the Supreme Court arguments in Michael Ratner's case, where Justice Ginsburg asked the government lawyer, what about torture? What if these people are tortured? And the government lawyer said, oh, you don't need to worry about that because we don't torture. And that night, CBS 60 Minutes 2 released the first photographs from Abu Ghraib, which illustrated torture not in Guantanamo, in Iraq, but it was virtually identical to the treatment that the Guantanamo detainees had described had happened to them. And then, you know, that made it very hard for the Supreme Court to accept President Bush's position that they should just defer blindly to executive power and trust the government that it will not mistreat people. And the court, for the first time in its history, ruled against the president on his treatment of of quote-unquote the enemy during wartime.
It's an interesting contrast between the idealism and then pragmatism. So some people would only work on the pragmatic side, while somebody like Michael Ratner would work on a more idealistic perspective, but not without pragmatism, but still just bringing these things forward as an ideal itself.
I mean, I think that the NRA views that the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, is critical as an ideal. The marriage equality folks think the equal dignity of gay and lesbian people is an ideal. But they have the luxury, in a way, of sort of acting in a slow, strategic manner over time, and which is exactly what they did. But when you're representing, you know, people who are locked up without trial, some of whom are being tortured, you don't have the luxury of sort of slowly developing your campaign. You've got to file, but you can't just file and hope that by making a clever argument in the Supreme Court you're going to prevail. You have to do the hard work that outside of the courts, and most of the work that I talk about in this book, even though it's a book about constitutional law, most of the work that is done that effectuates constitutional change takes place outside the courts, to shift the lens, to shift public opinion, to frame the dispute in a way that makes it more likely that you will prevail. And Michael Ratner and CCR were very effective at doing that. But I do focus on individuals in the book: Michael Ratner, Marion Hammer with the NRA, Evan Wolfson with Freedom to Marry on the marriage story, because I think they're fascinating individuals. Their stories are very interesting. But the bottom line is that they couldn't have done it without the committed, coordinated support of many, many other individuals and working in groups. And so it's really, as they say, a book about Citizens United as opposed to a book about heroes.
You say that most of this occurs outside of the courts and outside of that venue, but you also need the courts and you need to have the statutes in order to even press these cases. You mentioned Ratner himself pioneering the use of certain statutes. What did he pioneer in terms of using statutes in these cases?
Well, in this instance, he took, you know, one of the oldest statutes, the habeas corpus statute, which says that when you're locked up, you have the right to demand that a court look at whether there's a legal basis for your being locked up. And he applied it in a context where it had not been applied before, where the Supreme Court had said it doesn't even apply to the claims of enemy detainees during wartime. So that's a case of taking an old statute and pressing it into use in places where it had previously not been deployed. In other instances, I think people got statutes passed to protect rights where there wasn't a constitutional protection. That's what the NRA did. Much of its work in the states was passing laws, not amending the state constitution. And the marriage equality folks did much the same through the domestic partnership laws, through non-discrimination laws, and the like. But in each instance, they're using these statutes as forums for discussion of a norm that ultimately they would like recognized as a constitutional norm.
From this work that Michael Ratner has done, and the ACLU has filed some lawsuits now. And so now you've written a piece a couple of weeks back in The Nation about how maybe now some of the people who were responsible for the torture will finally be held accountable, whereas up until now there hasn't been any kind of account. What are those lawsuits? What has happened until now, and what do you think is going to happen?
So accountability for torture has been a vexed issue in this country. We know that torture happened. We know that it was approved at the very highest levels, all the way up to President Bush himself. We have the pictures. We have the accounts. We have some of the CIA's own documents have been disclosed. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence has investigated and reported on the practice. And yet no one has been held accountable in any sort of formal way for what are war crimes and crimes against humanity and grave human rights violations. So what the courts up to now have done is they have essentially extended immunity protections to anybody who's been sued, often on grounds that even addressing the issue would disclose secrets that would threaten the United States' national security in one way or another. But advocates have not given up, and that's an important point. Nobody wins every case, but you have to keep at it. And so there are now two cases pending that I did write about in The Nation, one in out west, I think in Washington State, and the other, or Oregon, I can't remember for sure, and the other in Virginia. One is suing a private corporation that was involved in the torture of Abu Ghraib detainees, a contractor. And the other is suing the psychologists who were hired by the Army to come up with the CIA's interrogation tactics, which included waterboarding and the like. And at the district court level, at least, courts have, out west, have rejected the argument that the psychologists can't be sued. And I think there's a very strong likelihood that the Court of Appeals in the Virginia case will similarly hold that the private contractor does not have immunity. And so, you know, this doesn't hold President Bush responsible if these ultimately succeed, but it's a step forward. It's a step forward. And then if they're responsible, what about the people who hired them to do what they were doing? Shouldn't they be responsible as well? So, you know, when a country's most powerful leaders have committed wrongs, it's critical to the rule of law that they be held accountable, but it's also the most challenging context in which to hold people responsible, where you're trying to hold responsible those who are very powerful, have very powerful friends, and the like. And so here, too, I think you have to act incrementally, and you have to look for alternatives. And so people did sue Donald Rumsfeld, and people did try to sue Bush, but those have not succeeded. But if these others succeed, they may develop precedents that make it easier to go up the line.
The book, again, is called Engines of Liberty. We've been speaking with David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. He's an award-winning author. His eighth book, Engines of Liberty. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar's Circle, David Cole.
My pleasure.
Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. See you next week.